You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and today we're discussing what it means to decolonize the curriculum. We've got a good range of perspectives on the topic today, and I will let our guests introduce themselves. So, Mira, would you like to begin?
Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Sabaratnam. I'm Senior Lecturer in International Relations at SOAS, and I'm also Chair of the Decolonizing SOAS Working Group.
Hi, I'm Kalika Kolawole. I am a postgraduate student of African Studies from SOAS University, and I am a facilitator of decolonizing higher education toolkits across schools.
Great.
Hi, I'm Miriam, and I am a member of the Gara Goldsmith Anti-Racist Action, with some occupation, and a former member of the National Union of Students National Executive Council.
Fantastic. Thank you, everyone, for joining me today. Mira, I'd like to start off with you and just thinking about decolonizing the curriculum. This is obviously a talking point that has been on higher education, this higher education agenda, for a number of years, but mostly, well, it began mostly in a South African context, and it has kind of made its way to the UK and other university campuses across the world. But I'm just wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit about kind of what it really looks like in a UK context.
Yeah. So it's certainly true that the struggles in South Africa inspired a lot of mobilisation in the UK, with students asking questions about why their syllabuses were very Eurocentric, why they didn't learn about different areas of the world, or if they did learn about them, why they were learned about in quite stereotypical ways, and always from the perspective of people who were based outside those spaces. So that struggle has been active in the last few years. However, these have been questions which have been raised since the beginning of universities, right? Who's in them? Who gets to speak? Who gets to write the narratives? Who writes the histories? Whose theories are they? Who develops the methodologies? Who gives consent for research? So all of these questions have been around for as long as academic knowledge has been around.
Hmm.
In the UK, we have a very interesting relationship with it, in part because knowledge about the British Empire in particular, you know, Britain's own empire, is very poor and very patchy in terms of the general public and the general knowledge. Many of us were not taught anything about it really at all at schools. What we were taught about it might be quite heroic, might be quite triumphant. You might learn about Wilberforce and the end of slavery. You never learn about the beginning of slavery and who sponsored it and who profited from it and so on. So we have a very, very bad understanding of colonialism, its role in Britain, the ways in which it's configured British society to be racially unequal, discriminatory, and also how Britain's relationships with the rest of the world are configured. So decolonising the curriculum in the UK is about saying, okay, what is it that we're teaching ourselves that gives us this very distorted view of the world?
Hmm.
And once you actually start to look at the experiences of people who are on the receiving end of empire, from their perspectives, from their agency, from the ways in which they've understood and interpreted the world, you get a very different account of the world.
Hmm. And we say decolonizing the curriculum, but it's obviously a much wider process. Can you go a bit more into, we're not just talking about taking kind of white authors off a curriculum or maybe including some disenfranchised voices in a curriculum that perhaps weren't there historically. This is a much broader campaign. Can you go into that a little bit more?
Yes, I mean, really, we're asking big questions. What is education for?
Mm.
What is society like? What should it be like? And how can we remake and reform the institutions within society? Can we remake and reform the institutions within society to make society a more liberatory place, a more just place?
Mm.
When we think about the university as an institution, it's not just a place that produces knowledge, it's also an employer, right? So how are different workers treated? It's also materially kind of gaining and spending money. Where does its money come from? Whose money is it? Who profits from it? Who benefits from it? It's also a place where norms and cultures are set, right? So when young people come into an institution, what are the norms and the culture that they experience? Who's enforcing those norms? Who's not enforcing those norms? What happens to people who do engage in racialized abuse or harassment? Does anything happen to them?
Mm-hmm.
So universities are in some respects a sort of microcosm of society, and they're an important institution within society because they're also access to privilege and to jobs and to all of those things.
Mm.
So it's very important that universities as a space are working properly for all of its members.
There's lots of talk about decolonizing pedagogy as well and decolonizing teaching, and I'm wondering if you could go into the specifics of that. What exactly does that look like?
Yeah, so this is a good question. In some respects, I think this is maybe a more important question than the content of the curriculum, which is also, you know, very important. Decolonizing teaching, or thinking about teaching as empowering people who have suffered from racism in their lives. Like, what does it mean to teach with an awareness that racism exists in society? It might exist in your classroom. It probably exists in the minds of yourself and all the people in the room. How do you lead a discussion? How do you teach a class? How do you empower students in that context? And I think teachers need to learn how to teach with that awareness. Now, one of those things is thinking about, do I have the same expectations of all the students? Am I paying the same amount of attention? How am I giving feedback? Am I giving people equal opportunity to speak and to give their perspectives? Am I correcting misapprehensions and stereotypes that are going on? Am I available to students? How am I available to students? Are only the most privileged, confident students going to come and visit me in my office hours? How do I make myself available to other students? How do our marking criteria work such that it's not just about privileging a certain tone of voice, but actually the content of what we're looking at? So there are all kinds of ways in which, just in the space of the learning and teaching relationship, you can think about how racism might affect those interactions and how you can take steps as a teacher to counteract that.
I'm wondering if we could switch gears just slightly, because one, I guess, question that stands out in my mind whenever we're thinking about just kind of universities and the role of universities and kind of the reputation that universities have right now across the world, is there a risk that whenever there's kind of, I guess, this challenge, this interior challenge about what knowledge is and where knowledge is coming from, is there a risk that that could potentially contribute to this kind of more general doubt of what university is, what experts are, and perhaps even contribute to some disinformation campaigns or be used in that way? I mean, is that a risk, and is that something that we should even be concerned about and worried about?
I think that's a good question, and we've seen a number of cases where people doubting a particular form or a particular dominant form of knowledge has been manipulated as the questioning of all kinds of knowledge, right?
Right.
So just because your idea of what gender is not stable, therefore we can't know anything about gender. That's a ridiculous position, but one which is opportunistically mobilized by people who want to undermine a particular agenda. I don't spend too much time worrying about people who are really out for that kind of agenda. I think they have their agenda. I think the best way to deal with them is to educate people as well as possible so that they are equipped with the knowledge and the understanding that means that they don't fall for that line of argument. And I know that there are a significant number of people who do.
Great. I'm wondering if we could bring in Miriam and Kalike. In terms of just where students are involved in this conversation, a lot of the campaigns that we've seen have been mostly student-led campaigns by, I'm thinking like Roads Must Fall or some of Why Is My Curriculum So White at UCL. A lot of them are student-led, and I'm just kind of wondering from a student's perspective, how do you feel about that? Does it kind of add insult to injury that this is coming from students? Do you wish that this was more coming from the senior management team, that this is something that university leaders need to wake up and do themselves, or do you think this needs to be a real student-driven change?
No, I think it needs to be consciously driven by both all entities. It can't be exclusive to one party. And yes, the students have a significant place in the discussion to even be leaders in the discussion, given that it is their learning experiences and their experiences within the university and within these institutions. And so, yeah, it has to be fundamentally collaborative if it is going to be effective in place. And only also because pedagogies as well and teaching in the classroom is both informative and performative. So we have a place in that classroom to address the institutions, our place within them, our position. And so ultimately, yeah, it has to be a collaboration.
Kalika, I'm wondering if you could go in specifically to some of the practical tips, because I know that you help facilitate these toolkits, which I think sound like an amazing idea, and I'm sure something that universities around the world would be very interested in hearing about. What would be some practical tips that you could offer to university leaders or academics who are listening to this right now?
Okay, so I'll talk about it from the level at which I carry out workshops in schools.
Mm. These are like primary schools, elementary schools?
Secondary
schools, okay.
Up to about the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenges which we address are predominantly having a centre of knowledge that becomes an infinite source of meaning, so the West being the local and the global, and then expanding that across the globe, and challenging their positionality in their research, in how they critique things and what critique is, in how they even carry out research. And so the first thing that we always do is just challenge our own biases or challenge our assumptions of histories. And so I usually use two cardinal characters in history, which are Winston Churchill and Gandhi. And I ask the students to just call out adjectives that they would apply to these two characters. And usually it's very scrupulous adjectives, so a leader, champion, altruist, kind. And then we kind of break down into their actual realities and their histories that have been evaded. So with Winston Churchill and the famine and his genuine hate for Indian people and non-white people, and Gandhi and his rallying against discrimination in South Africa, but exclusively for Indians. In that as well, I'm challenging their biases because they didn't carry out any research. When they call out things, they're predominantly calling out opinions and not thoughts. And their position there is just that this is what we've been taught, this is what we receive, but how do we go forward and kind of challenging the larger narratives and challenge the assumptions that we make, the literature that we read. And so, in effect, how do I criticize? And what is criticism?
And do you have any practical tips in terms of some of the points that Mira had picked up on, just kind of looking at like hiring practices or who we're putting in front of students? Are those things that you go into as well, or are you mostly focused on kind of the content of what students are studying?
Yeah, so predominantly it is content, but I think when it comes to the classroom as well, yes, in terms of hiring, I mean, the same applies. If we're an institution that claims that knowledge is universal, then the institution should reflect that practically. And so we should have a student body and an academic body and a teaching body or staff in general that equally aligns with those beliefs and reifies it in the classroom so that we aren't learning things from one source or one institution.
I think it's... Sorry, did you have something to add?
I wanted just to touch on that because I think waiting to do decolonizing work at a university is a bit too late, and is because if you look at all our curriculum from nursery to primary school, secondary school, you know, reception is all really Eurocentric. It's all really white centrist. For example, nursery rhymes, if you look at it, the books we read to our kids, even the toy we play with, is all Eurocentric. You have, you know, you have a black kid that have a white doll, and even like GCSEs, if you look at it, for example, last year there was this racist textbook, which was a psychology GCSE textbook, which is have really problematic content within the textbook, was talking about stereotypes on how Asian families, they all live in one, and the dad tend to be separated, other points on African Caribbean families and so on. So I feel like waiting to do that work when people are in university, where actually have gone through all those kind of steps of education, is a bit too late. But also in universities, I think we need to remember those institutions who are made for. It wasn't for black and brown kids. For us, accessing university is a privilege in a way, as what, you know, the narrative, because we are not meant to be in those spaces in the first place. Those institutions aren't built for us. So dismantling the institution, dismantling the narrative, that's the first step forward before being able to do any decolonized work, because those spaces weren't meant to be for us. it wasn't for us at all. So that's the first step. And
I was just going to say a point of clarification on one of Mira's point, which is it's not a bad thing for a black child to have a white doll. It's just that a white doll is the standard.
Mm. It's kind of the default.
Exactly. Idolized. And it is the norm because they are sold way more and in far more present.
Mm.
But I think it's also just important for listeners to know why decolonialism is so important at an earlier stage and level. Mm. And from my first encounter with decolonialism was, okay, fortunately my parents read very diversely, and so I found refuge in the books that were in my home. But really it was just that I was so elated. I went to secondary school in Kent, and I was the only black girl in my school for about 6 or 7 years. And then we were coming into, after doing studying World War I and World War II for what seemed like 400 years, we finally came to study black history. And we have two periods for each lesson for history, so it's 2 hours. And so, of course, at this time, teachers were allowed to actually allocate how much time they want to give to a specific topic. So we spent only an hour on black history. And the black history that I was taught was about African-American slaves, mm-hmm. which has no intimacy to me or my existence in the UK.
Mm.
And almost totally, like, evaded the existence of non-white people or black people in the UK. It's kind of like my presence there was the inception of black people being in this country. And so it led me to a course of decolonialism because I was dissatisfied with what I was being taught,
mm.
because I knew it was a lie, fundamentally. And not just simply because of that experience, but also because when we learnt about a war that is called World War I and World War II, I was always like challenged with the question as to why are only 4 countries involved in something that you're referring to as the world? And so not even being acknowledged or placed in that history, even though they were a significant part of its history and its success, was just incredible.
Hmm. I'm wondering if you think that if we're talking about university is too late, this needs to go right down to like the very beginning of education and just a complete overhaul of how we're teaching kids. Should this be a government mandate? Should this be something that needs to come from public funding and a real kind of national approach to redoing this? And how would that look?
So when you mandate things, people have an interesting reaction to them. I think we need to persuade people that this is an important problem and actually needs to be there from the beginning. But I do think we have in this country all kinds of equalities legislation that is anti-discrimination on the basis of race, gender, disability, and various other characteristics. And it shouldn't be beyond us to imagine that what we think constitutes a good and proper education must include this kind of worldly understanding of who we are and what we're about. So whilst I'm open, and as speaking as somebody who has a particular subject field, I don't necessarily want people from outside my field telling me how I need to do this thing, but I think the general kind of push to say, look, you can't just teach in this narrow way, that when we say quality in education, one of the things that we say is quality is the ability to actually expand that view.
Mm.
So I would like to see that sensibility embedded within our wider frameworks, and we have a number of them. And I think that would go a long way. Mm. But I don't think it can be achieved through necessarily a specific quota, unless that's what a particular community wants, right?
Mm.
If we want to say, you know, you must spend at least 2 weeks on this thing or that thing or the other thing in a national curriculum, that's a decision for people who decide on these things.
Mm.
And that could be very positive.
One of our demands was to have 20k annual fund allocated for Black History events and it's up to GARA and the student unions, basically, student of colour to use that fund to organise an event, because we tend to see when it's Black History Month, we just have like that month and we teach and it's really vague, really. All you have is like movie time with like about Malcolm X, about, you know, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, but how about black British black history? So, but I do think that it has to be coming from the top in government. They have a massive role to play on this, because if you say it's mandatory in a way, like students need to teach the teachers and lecturers need to teach this to students, it can actually have an effect. But understand what Mira says as well around not wanting to be told what to teach. But I think some teachers wouldn't have that, you know, that mind to do it on their own. And also when you come down to colonialism, I was lucky enough, I studied in Senegal as that here, I know that in the West, not only here, not only in the UK, even in France, you thought, oh, actually is the Africans that sold their own family members, when actually you're not thought about the big resistance that was having in African empires like Mali, like Ghana, the tribe in Senegal and more, and other books. So I think it's good as well to teach kids that actually we fought for it, but here you thought actually they saw their people,
right?
So
yeah, I think that's a good point as well, just kind of talking about this community who is kind of taking up this mantle and who actually is doing that work. And I mean at least in my experience of kind of observing this from the outside, it is mostly women who are doing it. Is that what you guys have seen? I'm just kind of noting that we're four women sitting around a table right now. First of all, is that something that you have noticed as well, and is there a problem with that?
I would say the majority of people doing this work that I know of are women, but there are men doing this work. We have Kennedy Andrews at Birmingham City University, William Acker at Birkbeck, Dave Thomas at Kent. So, you know, there are people who are doing the work as well. But then, yes, otherwise predominantly women tend to be the spokespeople. I mean, one of the reasons might be because I think lots of the conversations and the strategic questions and the issues have also emerged in the context of feminist struggles and feminist movements. Mm-hmm. And I certainly feel like I've learned a lot through thinking about how feminist struggles worked and operated. Mm-hmm. And I also find it useful to think about, okay, but would we say this thing about sexism, right? So when we say, oh, well, it's problematic to have BME-only spaces, no one complains about women's groups when you want to talk about particular issues, but they have an issue about this thing. I'm like, are we applying double standards here? So I think there is something about the intersecting of gender and race in terms of sensibilities and struggles that can explain some of this.
Okay.
But also women and non-binary people are always at the forefront of any movement. If you really look at in any other struggles and any other anti-racist campaign or any other really movement that have worked, it's either women and non-binary people that are at the front of it, really.
Was that the case with GARA? Were you a predominantly women group?
It was mainly women and non-binary at the forefront doing the work. Obviously, there was incredible men as well that had our back and everything, but the work, the labor was on predominant women and non-binary, really. Yeah.
I'm wondering if we could talk specifically now about the Goldsmith situation, and just for our listeners who perhaps don't know the specifics about that, that was a 137-day protest with students against a specific racist act that they were protesting against. Can you just go into some of the specifics?
Yeah, sure. So back in March, we went into occupation. It started actually. It was a last resort because there was several problems. We have flagged out to the senior management team. They have flagged out to lot of bodies within the university. Racist incidents within the institution. But the last year was at the student unions. Election time, one of the candidate, which is international student, was had her posters mocked And at the question time, at the election question time, she candidate question, she had her accent mocked.
Hmm.
So we went, nothing was done. The election went through. The bylaws say basically the election should have been stopped and investigation should have been done and went through the right complaining procedures.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing was done. It was just brushed off. She has lost time on campaign. She had to get all her posters back up again and stuff. So after when the election was over, we went to the Deptford Town Hall protest, where the Deptford Town Hall basically is the palace of senior management team. That's where the offices is. That's where most committees meeting happen and everything.
Mm.
So we went there to do a protest to flag what's going on to the senior management team, but they ran away and left us with the building. So we were like, right, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? There's no other choice. We're like, well, we went to the council chamber, which is like this amazing council chamber with painting of old mayors and a big piano and everything. So we're like, well, I guess this is where we're gonna stay. They left us with the building we're gonna occupy. But which is, it was a really, really last resort thing, because we have literally, you know, done everything, complain procedure, hey,
you went through all the university's established
process, but mm-hmm. nothing was done. And not only for about that incident, there is other incident where lecturers use the N-word in lectures, the counseling, the mental health services, which it says students, mainly international students, when they go there, oh, it's part of your culture, that's why you have mental health issues, those kind of comments. So we have done everything really. It was literally a last resort. So it was a people of color led occupation.
Mm.
I think one of the first, and we lasted for 137 days, almost 5 months really. But it wasn't easy. People have left their jobs, had to defer their year, but we had to do it because we were tired of trying to survive. We wanted to leave within the university, really. The second day of the occupation, we drafted a list of demand, which is a various list of demand, which is from in housing of the security workers, which is major party black and BME mainly workers, to the better well-being services, to a better complaints procedure, and that's 20k fund for the Black History Month,
right? And this was obviously, this was in kind of the final statement of commitments that the senior management team has signed on to and committed.
Yeah.
So it was the fund for Black History.
Yeah, 20K, which mm-hmm. is going to be rolled out annually.
And it was for more BAME mental health professionals?
Culturally competent.
Cultural competency for the university staff, faculty, senior management team.
Yeah.
The some service
training,
workers that you talked about. Yeah,
some training that will be race training on for staff and senior management team, but the senior
mm-hmm.
management team want to start it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also decolonizing the curriculum.
And decolonizing the curriculum, mm. which is add to the work of Dr. Nicola Rudd, which is, she's doing work at the moment on that,
mm.
but to get more support, because usually the university just get that token black person and say, oh, look, we've been amazing. We're doing this, but you
mm.
have just that black woman and the staff having to do all the work. That should be a years of work. So basically demand that actually will help her within her work, but also demands that have to do with the Deptford Town Hall, because the town hall, it should be a town hall, right? It was given to Goldsmiths University as a custodian, but basically on the contract they signed with the Lewisham Council, they was meant to basically give access to the local community. And basically we call out gentrification within New Cross and Deptford, because Goldsmiths have actually explained a major part of it. So we have a youth centre cut, we have a lot of cuts on that affects directly to the community. So we say we want the access for the community, basically to have access to the debt for a town hall.
Can I just come in there? And I think this is one of the most interesting and important demands within the GARA framework, because it's saying something very interesting about what universities can be, right? Universities should be connected to the communities that they're embedded in, that they serve. And in that sense, having a sort of local orientation to a university is not a bad thing, right? But it's all about who is engaged and how, and, you know, are universities public institutions? Are they public services? Not just for the students, but in terms of providing meeting spaces, theatre spaces, spaces for interface, dialogue. Do they give back to the communities that they depend on, right? I mean, these local communities are often supplying the low-paid workers that will come and work in the catering and the security services. There will be people sending their kids to university. Like, what is the university giving back to them? So I think this is just absolutely important. And I think when we talk about decolonizing, one of those elements of the vision has to be the connection between the universities and the community.
And the communities, and how they're serving them and who exactly they're serving in that.
And like, even the 20K, the community can use it, because we phrase it in a way which is like the 20K is for the students, and but also the community can use that fund to organize events on around Black history and teaching anything around Black history. But also the Deptford Town Hall has colonial statues, and with like slave ships, slave masters, and it has, the town hall have a really, really colonial past, so the university is going to put plaques on it to explain to the community, and it's really problematic, the community where it is, which is New Cross and Deptford, which
right.
is predominantly Black African Caribbean communities, which is slavery has affected us directly, so it's
literally warped into our imagination.
Yeah, literally, so we're going to place plaques, there's going to be work around Iwevo, which is a consultation around whether to remove the statues or
right.
what we want to do, but that's going to be the decision that the community will make, basically. So, yeah.
I'm wondering how you're going to kind of, because this is obviously a very massive, ambitious kind of statement of commitments that you've got the university to agree to, which is incredible, but I'm just wondering, how are you gauging success here, and how are you ensuring that all of those commitments actually happen?
I mean, I think that there's a little bit of background, because we have won this after the university called threatened us with legal action, like took us to court. And I want to stress the fact that we did our research. Like, the university senior management team came in a meeting not knowing anything after already 3 months of occupation. We did all the research, the homework, we put every resources. We are the one that did the research and work for them to do this job. And also, there is like, GARA is a continuous thing. Like, it's not like we want the demands, we're just gonna put our, we're just gonna sit down and move on. No, we're gonna be, there is working groups, there is people that will be, we make sure that each demand, there is continuous engagement of GARA within it, and where like we're going to be sitting in meeting with them, and we'll be making sure we're going to have meeting with senior management team after some of the demand are met, which is more straightforward. For example, the staffing, they already put out a job spec, and we make sure that they put it in forums where it's for Black academics and Black workers, where they can access easily. But there is working groups, there is committees as well, and the student union as well have been helping a lot around that.
Okay.
So we'll be like, we are following up, we're still in their back, we're not letting them go anywhere.
I think ultimately the colonizing the curriculum is the groundwork for mobilization across GARA anyway, because I think it's the point at which metamorphosis happens, because if you have an understanding and I can change your perspective, or you have a willingness to change your perspective and be critical and apply different research methods and knowledges at a younger level, then it's transformative across scale. And the institutions that we work in and the spaces in which we live and the interactions that we have will immediately be transformed. And these things can happen, and then we can be far more strategic about the spaces in which they happen and the conversations that exist in those spaces. So
I'm wondering what it means that it took a 137-day student protest and occupation to get to this point for a university like Goldsmiths, which does have a significant majority of Black and ethnic minority students.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just it's testimony to the truth that non-white people are silenced, and the claim of racism being subtle in the UK is really lethal and tactical.
I mean, I would say, as someone who's a bit older and who went to institutions which were very, very white in both kind of spirit and in personnel, that I think there's also something about there's more of us now. We are stronger. We talk to each other. There's more experience which we share across different spaces. There's more energy in the movement, and so and I think we're more willing to be assertive. Like my parents' generation, head down, shut up, don't get in trouble. I mean, yes, they protested, were part of anti-racist movements and so on, but they were also much more likely to just be quiet about these things. So even when my mum, she hears me on the radio talking about decolonizing the curriculum, she's like, why are you using that word? It's going to antagonize me. And I'm like, no, we can say these things now because we are, there's more of us and we're stronger. And I think that's important.
And also, like, we need to, like, remember Goldsmiths sell his bit, its business through how he's this liberal university. You know, I know a lot of people went to university to study politics because they feel like it was more, like, liberal, it was more, like, accessible than other, compared to LSE, compared to Oxford, compared to Cambridge.
Right.
But you have a Goldsmiths that all his business, all his history is around like how liberal it is, but yeah, it took us 137 days to get this demand that aren't even like exaggerated, that aren't like something that, you know, is massive. It's just something that we need as Black and brown students that we need for us to survive on a day-to-day basis and in university and being in that institution. So I think, but also what Mira says is really important, the fact that young people aren't silent anymore. We got to the point where like, we are tired, because when people asked, I remember like having a conversation with a white student around like colonialism. It's like, oh, that's the past. That's not, it has nothing to do with you now. It's like, no, because of colonialism, we still have institutional racism. It's still portrayed on our, like on our life, us, it's true. It was our ancestors that died on the sea and in the plantation, but yet we are still feeling the burden of it. We're still like, your ancestors are still benefiting from it. And I think Glasgow University did an amazing thing as well, which is like have committed to pay reparation after a study came out, which is research came out, which is they benefited from
slavery.
From slavery trade.
Yep, yep.
So I think that's really good.
Yep.
And we should be moving to that direction.
Plenty more work to do, and unfortunately we're out of time because I'm seeing now that our meeting room is being taken. So thank you so much, ladies, for joining me today. It was a short but quite lively and informative conversation. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.